Welcome to the Rosenfeld Review. I'm Lou Rosenfeld. You might have guessed that, but you may not have guessed that our guest today is Tricia Wong. Tricia, hello.
Hey, Lou. Good to hear you again.
It's great to talk with you. This has got to be at least the third time we've had you on the show, and it's not surprising. You're besides one of my favorites, you're a fan favorite. And there's also, you're a recurring guest at our conferences. And for those of you listening, Tricia is going to be one of the featured speakers at the end of day one of the 2 days of Advancing Research 2024, which is taking place in person in New York City, March 25th and 26th. So she's going to end the day on March 25th. And we're going to talk a little bit about what Tricia is going to be covering. It's got me pretty excited. But first, if you don't know Tricia, you should know that she's a social scientist, a consultant, and yes, a thought leader. And she really is. Tricia, I mean, you are someone who coined a term that's always meant a lot to me, thick data, to go up against big data, looking at more qualitative semantic insight as a important counterweight to what the data scientists have, in some cases, been pushing down our throats. Tricia co-founded Sudden Compass. She's advised industry giants at Google, Spotify, and Procter & Gamble. And she's working on a new book about how humans can be more human in the age of AI. Now, Tricia, would it be fair to say your talk at Advancing Research is how researchers can be maybe not more researchery, but better researchers in the age of AI?
Yes. Hey, Lou. I'm so excited to be coming back. And clearly, I have not pissed off too that many people if you keep inviting me back to your conference and podcasts. But yeah, this year, I am definitely pretty angry. So you're going to hear me speak really passionately, because that's where I get my inspiration the most and get where I get most of my thoughts is when I'm really fired up. And what I've been seeing lately is I'm pretty fired up about our future and how we talk about AI and the narratives we have around it. And I'm really excited, and I am excited and also, like, you know, angry about the way researchers are going to be having to confront AI and how we're going to have to integrate it. And I'm excited to apply some of the thinking that I've been doing around my book. My book is not for researchers, nor is it about research, but the implications are far reaching for many industries. And I'm really excited that I get the chance to talk about the implications for the industry that is closest and, you know, dearest to my heart, which is research and design.
So why are you so pissed off?
Well, I'm pissed off because I think that the narrative we have in the West and the US about AI at large is that it's a lot of fear mongering. And the worst part is that fear mongering is coming from the creators of AI themselves. So they're creating this binary where the conversation is all about, like, you know, we've created these amazing tools. And of course, these tools have been built off of stolen data and just copyrighted data and ripping off of everything that's ever, all knowledge has been created in humanity.
Yes, including publishers, I should mention. Looking at you, Meta, but that's another story.
Yeah, and they've created this thing and they're like, we've given you a gift and this thing is amazing. But also, by the way, it is advancing so quickly that it could take over humanity and kill you. And so you're just kind of like, as an everyday person, you're kind of like, okay, thanks. So it creates a lot of curiosity and excitement, because when someone's like, I've got a monster, here it is, try it out, you're going to be like, I'm going to try it out. But the way you're approaching this monster is not from a empowered position. It's kind of like, I'm tiptoeing towards this monster and I'm told I should try it out. I'm told it's going to take over and I'm told I need to get to know it. But this thing is pretty scary. And so I think they really dominate the narrative, that the headlines, the media headlines around this all support this, where it's like the creators of AI are saying that we're doomed, but this thing is just, you know, moving full forward. And it's confusing. So I think that's why I'm really upset about how we talk about AI. So there's a lot of hype and mania around it all at the same time. So it just makes it hard, I think, for people to approach it and use these tools.
Well, before we even jump into some of the specifics for researchers, let's stay at a broad level. And I know one of the things that you've been very interested in is the nature of and how we define the relationship between the human and AI. And I know you've thought of it as, at some points, you've tried out like a senior-junior partnership. I don't know if there are other metaphors that you're thinking about now. But I think ultimately you're saying that, you know, that big monster that's sort of being foisted upon us as if we're just like, you know, babysitters for the Frankenstein monster that, you know, unwittingly so or unwillingly so. You're saying actually we kind of have our hands on the strings. We actually can and should be the ones in control. So how do you... how do you define that relationship? Have you come up with a metaphor that feels right?
Yes, absolutely. I have spent months, with interviewing and studying and researching just like how people are using AI. And one of my hypotheses and my fear, like my hypothesis for why I was so excited to do this kind of research and take the time to really understand it, is that I hypothesize that we actually need a new framework for how we orientate ourselves towards technology, and in particular AI. Like, we need entirely new framing. Mm-hmm. And that framework will unlock the way we approach these tools with a different kind of mindset. And what I realize is that the identity that we have had over the last couple of decades has been one of where we are a user. Mm. You know, we literally call our field user experience, user research, right? We, as researchers, participate in this. And I realized, I was like, oh, we have been inculcated over the last couple of decades and forced into a system where what I call the culture of the user. And the culture of the user is one that's created by big tech. And really, now that there's digital transformation, it's all industries, right? But it started out with big tech. And it's how big tech got so big, is that they created this culture of the user. And the user, what you do is you need to keep the user on your platform, mm-hmm. because that means we generate data the more time we spend on the platform. And they will do everything possible using dark design that many researchers, including myself, have been complicit in, which is like, how do you get people to stay, you know, engaged, right? Get those engagement metrics up. But what this has done is that it's created this identity, this modern identity that is unique to our period, our technological, you know, history of this moment where we have the internet and the computer. And it's in a digital society where we're able to live this parallel life where we're not just physical beings, but we're digital beings. And in our digital humanity, we're not human beings. We are users. Tech and any kind of company that's collecting all this data about you, they see us as users. They treat us as users. And part of what it means to be users is that we take on this very passive kind of role, this passive orientation to technology, where we're not the builders. Maybe there was a point in time where there could have been hope with the open source software movement, and it would have, you know, empowered more people to be builders. But at this point, we live on platforms. We do we complete and execute our everyday life through platforms. And as a result, these platforms, they do everything for us, right? If there's a problem, you make a report and hope that someone can get back to you, but really there's no human to talk to on the other end. And so I think what's happened is that if you are a user and you approach a technology like AI, which is unlike any other, it's uniquely a different kind of technology than the internet and computers, because it reflects back to us. It uses our data, but also it can, makes autonomous decisions. It can process things at, speed that we haven't seen before. Is that you are actually not empowered when you are a user interacting with AI. And that kind of identity puts us at a disadvantage, because you're passive. And AI is not a finished product. It's something that needs to be trained. It requires active participation. It requires engagement. Otherwise, you can be misled. Otherwise, all the fears around AI could be true, which is like, you could be misled, it hallucinates, it generates false information, and it can easily, harm you through and create a lot of harm through this. And so what I realized, I was like, oh, who are the people using AI successfully, right? Mm-hmm. Like, who are the people cooperating with AI, where it seems like they're just able to be creative with it, they're even able to be subversive with it, but they're able to mold it and sculpt it. They just seem to like use it in a more seamless way. And they're able to combine human and machine intelligence in ways that amplify each other's strengths. And most importantly, who are the people cooperating with AI and using it in a way where they don't surrender their own autonomy or individuality in the process, and don't create more harm, right, for other communities or their own community? And I realized, I was like, there's a new identity emerging around people who are using AI, who aren't losing their humanity. And those people I call shapers. Mm. And that's the new emergent identity that is that I'm seeing coming out, that's consistent amongst people who are able to cooperate with AI, and they're able to treat it as a partner, but really it's like they're actively shaping it. And the relationship, most importantly, is not based on domination. It is not based on dominance. It is not about how can I beat the AI. It's not even like, how do I control the AI? I think control is a tricky word, because like, of course we want to maintain control. Of course we want to have our agency, but their mindset is not like, how do I manipulate and like force this thing so I can be better into it? It's more like, how do I play with it and get it to do what I envision, but how do I leverage it and allow this thing that we're going to create to emerge based on interaction? And so I'm seeing that blending of like where the binary between human versus AI is really blurred by shapers. They're not like trying to say, oh, I made this and therefore this is my contribution and there's AI's contribution. They're much more open to seeing it as like a shared outcome, shared product, where who did what doesn't even matter. But it's very clear that the human, that they themselves were inculcating it with their values and guiding it the entire time. Like, they don't feel like they lost any part of themselves, or their agency.
I love, first of all, your indictment of the concept of user, which is actually by extension, really, let's face it, it's an indictment of capitalism, right? But, we've been users of the news for years, right? We've consumers passively accepting with occasional bursts of outrage, which is just a tempest in a teapot. It doesn't do any good. And it's the same thing with politics, right? We've been passively using information and experiences that come out of politics and politicians. And in a way, you're saying the same thing. Now, when you were talking about the metaphor you're using of shaper, which I think really makes great sense, I had there was a moment there, I thought, knowing you well enough to know you're a proud doggy parent, I thought you were going to like reference, having a dog and you're the senior partner in that relationship, but they have some unbelievable powers, specialized skills that humans don't have. But shapers is just, it's powerful. It implies for me material, right? So you're talking about both a combination of AI generated ideas, but also AI generated functionality or power. being shaped as a, in effect, a new kind of material. I think this would be a perfect time for us to take a break, because after the break, I'd like us to get into how researchers could be shapers, to use your metaphor, in years to come, and maybe the risks if they don't adopt this approach. So let's take a quick break. We're listening to Talking with Tricia Wong, and you're listening to The Rosenfeld Review. Be right back. Hey, it's Lou, and you know that I like to tell you about upcoming conferences. We do four of them a year. This one's extra special. Advancing Research 2024 is going to be the first in-person conference we've done since 2019. Thank goodness. I can't wait to see people in person. It's going to take place in New York City at the Museum of the Moving Image, a great venue. We've used it before. March 25th and 26th, with workshops on March 27th. Advancing Research, this is the fifth edition. We really speak to people who are at least midway through their careers and are looking to get way past the 101 stuff. You'll love to know that the featured speakers are Tricia Wong, Victor Udawewa, Steve Portigal, and Neil Barry. Got some other great people on the program, like Nalini Kuttenraju, Nick Fine, Robin Beers, a bunch of other great folks, and a great lineup of workshops. So if you are a researcher of any kind and you want to be with other researchers in a really great intimate venue with really high quality content, join us at Advancing Research 2024. Check it out at advancingresearchconference.com. Lou here again. Welcome back to the Rosenfeld Review. With Tricia Wong, who will be speaking at Advancing Research in New York City on March 25th. So, Tricia, you were helping us understand how we as humans can get beyond this sort of passive, dumbstruck babysitter, hope to not get killed by the golem of AI approach, and thinking more about how the metaphor of shaper is maybe a more realistic, reasonable, and sound approach to how we relate to AI. So what about researchers? There's all this concern. Obviously, the field has experienced tons of layoffs. And I don't know how many of those layoffs have been induced by the threat of AI automating what researchers do, but I have a feeling you've got some opinions on this.
Yes, I do. Well, the first thing is, look, if I'm saying that, like, we need to, my big rallying cry, my call to action is for everyone, for society, for us to stop being users and to start being shapers, then we have to look at, where is the user being produced? Where is that being maintained? Where are the sites of production of the user? And it's really, you know, if you work in big tech, you are in at the core site of production. But if you work in any company that gathers data about people as consumers, and you're trying to keep them on your site as users, then you're also part of that production. And so, which I think is just most people, you know, most researchers, we work in a digital world that you are given this mandate to keep your users engaged. And my thinking is that we first have to acknowledge we have to reconnect back to what is the role of the researcher in the first place. You know, is it just to be a yes person and do exactly as the company says? Or are you there to represent the needs and desires of people, not of users? And that is my question to you. And I'm not, clearly I have a point of view of, like, we should be representing people, right? Mm-hmm. That is what we should be doing as researchers. But I think everyone has to have, it's not a binary either, because I'm not like, oh, if you're doing anything to encourage people to be users, then, like, you're not a real researcher. So that's not what I mean at all. But I'm saying that in this kind of tension that we researchers and designers, you know, have to live, is that we're constantly being like, we are at that intersection. We are the we sit at that membrane of the corporation, of our clients, of the government, whoever it is, right? The entity in which we represent. We are the ones with the mandate to have one foot out and to be like, what is happening amongst the people we serve, whether you call them citizens or customers or users, but you know, if you're digital, I'm going to say they're users. And how do we represent the needs of the company or the entity, the government, you know, my employer, right? How do I represent their needs? And how do I talk about that in a way where I'm doing my job? And that's very hard. Like I think have one of the toughest jobs in the industry for that reason, because you really are exposed to what your users want. And if you just open your eyes, if you're just willing to listen. And so I think that there's a first like existential question that we have to ask ourselves. And this mm-hmm. is a moment that my framing of this forces that question to be like, what is your job? Who do you represent? And how do you represent that? And it's not a binary. You can't just be like, I only represent people. And it's like, well, you're not gonna have a job then, because your employer needs you to represent their needs. And then you have to go back and be like, how much do my employer's needs and KPIs and goals represent align with serving people, right? But that's exactly your job is to, you should be the one that is squarely in those conversations and helping your client or your employer negotiate that and understand that. That is the work. It is not clean. It is not easy. It should not be righteous either, because no one really, it's not about like only one party getting what they want, but you are that person, I think, that is in charge of negotiating that conversation. So the reason why I think AI forces this is because when you're in the culture of the user and where users are passive and really the KPIs have been to keep users engaged for as long as possible and to generate, to get them to produce as much data, then if you just add AI on top of that, I think it's going to only exacerbate what we already have, which is a long century effort to engineer consent of the masses mm-hmm. and social media really cinched that, right? Because if we didn't have, I mean, you see how the current elections are playing out in the US, where it's all about how much money can you sink into social media, some TV, you know, for the olds, but really it's like, how much can you sink into social media platforms to engineer people, to sway people? Is that if you add AI on top of it, it really only is going to do more of what we already know, we already see.
So if I can just try to paraphrase that a bit, yes, right, please. Now we are at risk of using AI to continue engineering consent. In other words, well, we can gather more data and we can summarize more data and do all these things more, but in the wrong direction. So rather than engineering consent, it sounds like you're suggesting that researchers in these environments, which are going to have increasing amounts of, you know, AI functionality, really need to be not about consent, but consensus. So we're like the negotiators of the reality of a broader conversation that includes stakeholders, as well as people who interact with our products, as well as AI.
Yeah, I like that. I like what you said about like, it's not about engineering consent, which consent produces more data.
Yep.
Time spent engaging on platform, but it's really about playing a more strategic role, which is getting consensus at a strategic level, leadership level, around what is the purpose of our product and like how do we actually serve, give people what they want, but do it in a way where we're not just like controlling them and actually making their lives worse. And I think anyone who is working square, and there's degrees of difference where I think like if you're working at a social media company where that consent is most directly being manufactured, then like that is that's a much more existential question, right? But if you're like at a CPG company and just trying to get people to like buy more of your soap, it's less, you know, there's less at stake. So right. There's varying degrees.
So if a researcher then is in this sort of role of facilitating a conversation that leads to, if not consensus, like a better picture of reality, not just the stakeholders' reality, but the environment that the business lives in and the products exist in, then I guess a research, like, okay, so first of all, we're kind of leaving, we're assuming that there's just like a lot of mechanical aspects of research that are probably going to go away, the kind of work that may be done by extremely junior people today is probably not going to be out there much longer. And there is a risk there for those people who don't move their careers in new directions. But there's also like something you and I have talked about a lot over the years, this idea of synthesis. And it seems like AI might actually position us to synthesize across different kinds of evidence, qualitative and quantitative, behavioral, attitudinal, et cetera, in ways that really help us like make this incredibly strategic impact to really facilitate consensus in ways that we couldn't before. I mean, is like, are you seeing that? Is AI the sort of secret ingredient to help us do truly powerful synthesis?
I think I would like to see that, and I'm doing that, but I would love to talk to researchers who are doing that. I'm having trouble because of the culture of the way we talk about AI in the West, is that there's a lot of shame around using AI. There's a lot of ambivalence. There's a lot of nervousness, right? It's seen as like, oh, AI is taking over this part, right? Or it's like, oh, AI is taking over the dumb parts of work, the mechanical parts of work. And so that I can be, but the higher order work is not under threat, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm like, no, you should be integrating AI in all aspects of the work. Mm-hmm. And precisely because of what you just said is like, how do you use it to be more strategic? So like what I see that a lot of researchers, you know, what we need to do is so much of like building that consensus, which is like, how do I convince you of a decision that you already have set in mind, right? Because that's the reality we're often walking into. We're being asked to do research to confirm something that's already been decided. It's just to get data to backfill that answer, where it's like, what I wish researchers, the skill of really highly skilled researchers, they're able to acknowledge that that's the case, that, you know, whatever party, this is where their decision's already been made, but they're able to use that language and meet people where they're at, and then show how the research challenges that, but they're able to do it in a way that leads them to not feel like they are being challenged, but it feels like a win-win. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the skillfulness of very senior researchers. And it has nothing to do with a degree. I find that researchers with PhDs are the worst at this because they're all about being right and about sticking to the facts and sticking to the reality of their observations. To the data, right? Where it's like so much about research is half of it is about gathering great data. The other half that's much harder is about the communication and collaboration with your counterparts or much more senior people to get them to see this reality that is beyond the membrane of your entity. And that's really hard because when you're in an organization, all these forces are put in place to create all these layers between you and your user, your customer, your human being, right? And so your job as a researcher is to really knock down those layers, but you're not gonna get far if you're seen as wielding a big sword mm-hmm. or a big army of data points. Oddly, you have to find a way to speak to people in a way they don't feel that you're threatening them. And that's the reality of how you work inside a large corporation. And I think, and anyone who's been successful for a while knows that's the case, is you have to develop trust over time, by not looking like you're being a sword, but by saying, hey, let's like break down these walls together.
Time is always the critical ingredient, right? And to get to this mode of being able to not beat people up with data, but to facilitate a conversation, it's really hard to see how you do that when you're new. Now, it's interesting because I just spoke on the Rosenfeld Review. I interviewed Victor Duwewa just 2 days ago. He's also one of the invited speakers at Advancing Research. And we talked a lot about the sort of Western perspective that leads us to want to not collaborate, but win. So, I AI is coming for me. One of us is going to be left standing at the end of the day. I hope it's me. And, you know, that's a problematic attitude to take, even if we don't, if we're not just talking about AI. It's really anything that requires different perspectives to come together in order to advance a conversation. I find it very insightful that you're finding that some of the most, quote, qualified researchers, unquote, the ones with PhDs and whatnot, are often the least equipped to have those conversations. So let's wrap it up.
I agree.
I'm going to put you on the spot. And then I'm going to ask you for your gift for our listeners. But first, putting you on the spot, if I'm a fairly new, inexperienced researcher, and I'm looking forward to the next few years with the advent of AI being sort of a fait accompli, what's your advice for me?
My advice to you is that just embrace AI tools and play and practice with as many as possible. And I would say that you're so lucky to be coming of age and as a researcher in a period where you have access to all these AI tools, because it means that a lot of the rote work that a lot of junior researchers had to do, and even senior researchers, if you don't have a big team, you either have to outsource or do it yourself, is that a lot of that can be done by AI now. And a lot of that you get to actually then free up your time to actually spend on refining and perfecting your skills in what I think is the most important part of research, which is communication with your counterparts, really understanding the other people in your organization, and also spending more time with your people who you're researching, right? What probably many of you are calling users. So much of, you know, when you look at a researcher's time, they're not actually spent in field. They have to like grovel for time to go into field, right? You're just doing like a quick interview, or you've outsourced a work to an agency to do the interview. And then you don't have enough time to even have lunch and get to know your counterparts who need your research. All of that is freed up now. And I think it's so exciting that you get to be creative with that work and find a way to, you know, my second piece of advice is like, these tools are coming out now. I don't even know which tool to recommend, so I'm not going to mention them because I'm still experimenting with them myself. But what I see happening is that you have the opportunity, that we have the opportunity to make research into an artifact. We have an opportunity to materialize it and make it more accessible in ways that we could have never before. You know, before we were stuck with like sticky notes and the physical war room of research. And it was very difficult to bring stakeholders in, and you have to like plan workshops, and which I'm not saying any of that goes away. But also then once our research was digitized, it's like all these files, they live, you know, in Google Docs and long transcripts. And then we have to like prepare PowerPoints. Again, I don't think any of that goes away, PowerPoints and storytelling. But I think now what I see the opportunity is that we can make some of our research actually turn it into interactions. And you can actually turn it into an artifact to say, hey, I did this research. Here is a transcript, not literally giving the file, but you could say, here, I've already uploaded the transcript to one of our AIs, to one of our GPTs or whatever, right? Into our LLM. And now you can ask it questions directly. Here's a summary, and here's some questions you can ask. And so that way you're empowering the rest of your organization, your counterparts, to actually query and prompt the transcripts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that to me is so exciting. Now, I think a lot of researchers are threatened by that because they're like, well, that's my job. I'm supposed to, you know, I find out what you want. Then I become that person who is, you know, I go back to the transcript and I make that analysis.
It is exciting. And, you know, I'm just reminded of the at least working title of your talk at Advancing Research, which is your talk's coming up on March 25th. Redefining Research, Welcome to a New Paradigm with AI. Tricia, this is going to be fantastic. And, you know, we're just scratching the surface of what I think you're going to get into at the conference. So I really appreciate your time today. We just have a minute or so. Did you bring a gift for our listeners?
I did. I brought two gifts. These are, they're texts. The texts that have like, one's a book and one's an article, and they've been a lot on my mind. The first one is James Bridle's Ways of Being. It's a book. It's called Animals, Ways of Being, Animals, Plants, Machines, The Search for a Planetary Intelligence. Mm. And I love James as a writer. He's one of the most creative writers I know out there. And he really, he talks about machines and nature with a fluidity that breaks down a lot of the binaries that we tend to ascribe to our world. So I just love him because he's just like such a big thinker. And so I definitely recommend any researcher to read that if you need like just, you know, big picture inspiration.
Until your book comes out.
And yes, until my book comes out. And then the second piece I want to recommend is an article by Brett Christophers, who's one of my favorite writers. He's is a professor at Uppsala University in Sweden. And he writes a lot about this new, the renter capitalism, right? And he has a specific article that I love though. He's written a book about renter capitalism, about essentially, you know, that we are a society of renters and then you have like the elite who are the owners, right? And, but he has a really great article that is such a gem that documents exactly how asset managers came to rule the world. Hmm. And that's the title of the article. And essentially it's how did asset managers create new assets to, you know, essentially make them into financial products that could be invested in. And so he talks about how housing infrastructure became an asset class that really was started by these Australian asset fund managers, but then perfected by US hedge funds like, you know, BlackRock. And so I'm interested in that because it helps me think about how we as digital human beings became an asset class. And it helps me think about how as users, we produce data that is really the new financial asset class. That data became somehow over the last 20 years, it moved from being a cost to being an asset. And we are that asset. And therefore, how did it start to dehumanize us? And so I just think sometimes that's such like a, it's such a mind fuck to think about how we as a, are an asset class as digital human beings. Mm-hmm. So I find it really helpful to understand that like, here's a parallel where housing became an asset to where now you have like a whole town he talks about in England where everything is owned by a private company, you know, from the sewage system, from the water to electricity, you know, of course the housing them, the houses themselves. And he talks about what is the social impact of that is that when it is completely monopolized by private industry.
Wow. So I'm going to say to summarize, Tricia wants you to stop securitizing your users.
Great summary. Wait, I have something to say I want to add though. Can
okay.
I add something? Yeah, is that I would love, if you're listening to this and you're using AI or you're ambivalent about using AI, please talk to me because I just want to talk to anyone and their thoughts about AI right now. Even if you're scared of it, even if you're worried about it, I want to spend time talking to you. So I think, and then if you're actually also integrating AI into your work and you're already experimenting, if you're experiencing resistance at your company, if you're experiencing like total encouragement, then like, I want to know about it. I want to know how you're doing this. And I'm doing these interviews and chats for my book. So it can be anonymous or it can be, you know, we can use your name, whatever it is. But if you just want to talk, I'm here. And it's this rare moment in my life where I'm like, anyone who wants to talk to me, just put time on my calendar. And I would love to hear your thoughts.
We
about
will
AI
make sure research. The show notes includes a way to reach you.
Yes. Thank you, Lou.
All right. We'll see you soon enough. Thanks again.
Thanks for listening to the Rosenfeld Review, brought to you by Rosenfeld Media. If you like our show, please subscribe and review it on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast platform. I'd love it if you tell a friend to have a listen and check out our website for over 100 podcasts with other interesting people. You'll find them all at rosenfeldreview.com.